Hello, and welcome to Things I Wish I Knew, the podcast from Thinking Faith, part of the Jesuits in Britain. We all live hectic lives and often don't get time to reflect on what's happening both to us and around us. This podcast is meant to help you to take a moment to stop and think about where you are, where you're going, and where your relationship with God fits into it all. So I'm Julia, I'm in my early 30s, and I live in a young adult Jesuit community in London. Every week, I'll meet a new guest who tells me about something they've experienced which changed their life forever. And by talking about the things they'd wished they'd known at the time, we'll explore the idea that God isn't all things, and we'll talk about the part that faith plays in navigating life's challenges. So today I'm speaking to Rose, and Rose speaks about her opportunity of living on a boat. And I love speaking to Rose because she really taught me about how you can learn from different lifestyles and gain a lot from it, and that really resonated with me. So Rose, tell me about yourself.
I'm Rose, I'm 27 and I'm a freelance writer, and for the last year I've been living on a boat in Oxford on the Thames.
And what surprised you the most about living on a boat?
How cold it gets in the winter. Through the autumn, people kept telling me to prepare for the winter, and I didn't know really what they meant or whether they were being dramatic, but we had a very cold winter. It got to minus 10 and my pipes froze and broke and flooded the boat, and the condensation would like ice over on the inside of the windows. So it took me a while to figure out how to heat the boat properly. And I think if I did another winter, I'd make sure I had a lot more wood.
So how do you heat a boat in winter?
So my dad actually built me a wood burner, which was really convenient. He'd already made me it because that's what he does. He makes stoves. And he installed that in November. And yeah, I was getting wood from this hardware shop, which is now sadly closed, and then cycling it down the towpath every couple of days. I think there are probably more practical ways to go about that, like maybe buying it in bulk beforehand. But, you know, it was a learning curve. And I think one of the really valuable parts of that experience was having to tackle these things and to be directly responsible for my needs. Like, usually you don't have to think about heat or water or electricity. You just pay a bill and press a button. And it was useful to realize how much effort actually goes into those things. I was living in London beforehand, and I was quite unhappy. I was living quite far away from people, and I'd moved from Oxford and didn't really know anyone. I just became quite isolated, and I was working for the Church of England, but also thinking about becoming a Catholic. So I ended up quitting the job and moving back to Oxford and didn't really know what I was doing. And then I remembered one day just walking down the towpath, this guy I knew who had a lot of boats, and I messaged him and he was like, yeah, I'll give you a boat. He drove up and we tidied it, moved all his stuff out. It was really full of spiders and like several layers of dirt and wires over the floors. And yeah, I think I had this quite romantic idea of like leaving society, you know, leaving employment and living in this, I guess, more sustainable way. I'd also thought about moving back to Wales and like growing vegetables, and I wanted to be sort of more responsible for my day-to-day needs and to figure out a way of living that didn't feel so alienating. So yeah, I had this quite romantic idea of, you know, being a freelance writer and living on this boat, and the boat was full of philosophy books. It sort of came with this library, which also doubles as insulation.
And can you describe the boat for us? Like, if you're imagining stepping onto it, what would you see in front of you?
So it's a seaplane tender from the 1940s. So it's a naval vessel. It's not really meant to be lived in. And I've spent a lot of time on my friends' houseboats, which are much cozier and also easier to heat. But it's very roomy. So it's got like this entrance room and then steps down to a kitchen and steps down to a bedroom. And one of the lovely things is waking up with the reflection of the light playing off the water on the ceiling, and you get this like rippling. And it's very, very beautiful. It's been really lovely to see the seasons change. In the winter, the entire Thames was iced over. And then, you know, I got to see all the trees change and the ducklings hatch. That was really nice. Kind of made it worth it.
As you said, it sounds like a very romantic style of life. Is it, or is that just me dreaming about it?
It's a really interesting community. I think when there's that shared experience of precarity and where you are responsible for your everyday needs in that direct way, like people really come together. And, you know, as soon as I moved in, people were offering to, like, lend me things and teach me how things worked. And, you know, sometimes someone's boat will go down and everyone will be out there, like, with bilge pumps, like, bailing it out. That's, like, a really special part of it. I wasn't really prepared for how hard it would be at times.
So you were just talking about that community element of living on a boat. And before you were saying about how you were feeling isolated in London. So that must be a really, like, nice change to be experiencing.
Yeah. It's really interesting as well being in Oxford, because now I have these sort of overlapping communities of, you know, academics and then Catholics and boat people. And it's like everywhere I go, I bump into someone. And because I've been there for about 8 years now, sort of on and off, it does feel like home. And I think that that element of community is really important. Like, something I've been thinking about a lot is, particularly within academia, like how, you know, jobs force people to move from city to city every couple of years, and it's really hard to put down roots. And I'm really grateful for that. And I think that is one of the most important things for me. And I've realized that that's something I wouldn't want to sacrifice for, like, career development. Like, I think it's different if you come from London or if you have a chance to really put down roots here. But yeah, I didn't in that time. And the boat community was really, really a gift in terms of just giving me this ready-made community. I think especially being on the towpath, because people will just, like, come by every day, bump into people, they come up for a cup of tea. Like, for a while I had my writing desk on the deck, sort of overlooking the river, and actually didn't get as much writing done as I wanted because I would just see people constantly. But yeah, it was really nice, and I feel like a real part of, like, a local community now.
That sounds really lovely. It's actually, that's one of the things I often find with people when they come to London, they can find it quite hard to find that sense of community. So that's really good to hear that you have found it.
Yeah, one of the quirks of this boat is that it's on a stretch of the Thames, which is technically owned by Christchurch. So the Environment Agency doesn't have any jurisdiction there. So nobody who's moored there pays mooring fees or license fees or gets boat safety certificates. So it's a really interesting collection of nonconformists and outcasts and dropouts of various types. And a lot of tour groups on the river who go past, and then the tour is commenting on how bedraggled everything looks. And, you know, initially I was really excited about not paying council tax and you know, having this independence and not being tied down by any rental contracts or employment contracts, and, you know, having this sort of complete freedom and independence. But it did make me a bit feral, actually. And I've realized that actually, you know, being part of civilization is quite important. I've gained more respect for sort of social infrastructure.
You are leaving the boat life for a little bit. And what are you going to do?
Yeah, I'm starting a DPhil, so I'm moving back into student accommodation, which I think will be good because I'll have Wi-Fi and a shower and running water, things like that. Being on the boat, it just takes a lot of time to take care of your daily needs, like figuring out how to do laundry or, like, making time to go to someone's house to shower. I mean, I ended up getting a membership at the spa in the winter just to have somewhere to shower, and because it was really cold. But yeah, it all takes, like, quite a lot of time. It takes a big chunk of your day, so it wasn't really something I could balance with a DPhil.
So what you were talking about made me think about how sometimes we can take for granted some of the things that we think are really basic, like having running water or showers and things. And so that sounds like it's been a bit of a challenge for you. So therefore, would you go back to living on a boat again?
Yeah, definitely. I think if I could save up and buy one of my own, I think it would really suit me. It just takes a bit more preparation. If I could have my own where, you know, it was sort of a legit boat and was well insulated and you know, where you have mooring fees, then you also have more amenities and you can have shore power and water and things like that. Yeah, it would definitely suit me. And I think especially the community element is quite hard to find.
So the boat life suits you, but you've made this decision to take some time out of boat life. What led you to that decision?
I think just while I'm doing the DPhil, I wanted to have, like, a shower and like Wi-Fi in particular. It's been really nice not having Wi-Fi in some ways, because it's made me read, and it means that like the first thing in the morning, I don't check my phone because I don't get any signal there either. So I have to do my prayers and pick up a book before I pick up my phone. But I think in terms of actually doing a doctorate, it would be helpful to have Wi-Fi where I live. It's been really difficult as well because everything's on Zoom now, and I've had to explain to people I don't have Wi-Fi. I can't do like a Zoom meeting. But in some ways, that challenge has been useful because it means that I've had to participate in things in person, and I've ended up going to a lot more reading groups and meeting up with people in person because I can't do phone calls there either. So I've had to go outside every day and see people, and I think I have a tendency to isolate and spend a lot of time in my room alone, and the last year has really knocked that habit out of me. So I hope that remains.
I'm definitely one of those people who could isolate in my room for like a whole week because I work from home apart from for this podcast. So it definitely sounds like I could do with a year of living on a boat just to get those habits out of my life. But what made you actually decide to do theology?
Yeah, I did medieval history before, so it's not a huge jump. My work before was on a sort of early medieval theologies and martyrdom. And then I was working for the church and, you know, knew I wanted to do something in the sphere of Christianity. But I guess when I was in London, I was still pursuing a career that would give me prestige, and I was still thinking about things in terms of job titles and you know what would look good in a Twitter bio, and I was always thinking about my CV. You know, I never wanted to have a gap on my CV, and it was just a very silly way of looking at it. And I guess when you're told sort of throughout school, you know, that's the most important thing, that you know, you sort of automatically think that way. But it meant that I wasn't really thinking about my work in terms of anything that actually meant anything. Like I wasn't thinking about what was nourishing my soul or what I was actually giving to people and what I could actually like offer in a meaningful way. So yeah, it sort of took things falling apart and you know, leaving my job and spending this year really thinking about what I wanted to do to follow a more authentic path. That sounds kind of wishy-washy, but
I think there's always a craving to be your more authentic self. You made the decision to become a Catholic. Was that an easy decision, or did it take a long time to consider?
Yeah, I was really scared of it for a long time, even like right up until confirmation, because I'd been an Anglican since I was 21, and my sort of social scene was sort of built up around that. So I was really afraid of offending people and losing friends. And I was still thinking about it in terms of what other people would think about me. And again, like it took losing a lot to be able to face that. And it ended up being okay, you know. Like I did lose some friends, but a lot of people like I spoke to openly and honestly about it, and it was okay. And you know, those things which I had a lot of fear around ended up being things that I could face, even if they were slightly uncomfortable.
I was just thinking that I often find that I can be closer to God in times of when I'm in hardship than it is for me in times when things are going wonderful and great, because in times of wonderful and great, I just think I'm just very focused on it being wonderful and great. But actually, it's in those lows that actually then I remember that I'm not doing things on my own, yeah, and that God is beside me as
yeah
well.
and you're forced to surrender and to abandon your will to God and to let God run the show, which is something I always struggle with and sort of have to do on a daily basis. But when I do it, you know, amazing things happen, miraculous things happen, people and opportunities present themselves. And there have been lots and lots of moments like that, you know, when people just show up with a bag of wood or something. And, you know, it's in those situations where I sort of trust in God that God does actually provide. Yeah, it's always still surprises me when it happens.
Yeah, it always surprises me. And actually, recently I went to Bordeaux Day, and I went with a big group, and one of the leaders of the group, she'd talk about people being God's angels, and they would just turn up and provide things. Like there was a guy who brought us all pizza because one night we couldn't find the restaurants and things. So it's incredible how much humanity offers as well. I want to ask you a question that you kind of answered about becoming Catholic, but I kind of want to ask you about when you end up living on a boat. How do people react to that?
Yeah, it's often interesting. Actually, when I was confirmed, I had a boat party, and this was deepest December. It was the feast of the Immaculate Conception. And I had, you know, all of these different people. I had like boat people, I had Catholics, I had like theology students, people I knew from coffee shops. And I was really sort of stressed about how all these people would get on. And, you know, I'd made a big stew, but I was really, you know, all in the day up to my confirmation, I was really worried about this party. But it was really fun, and everyone sort of crowded onto the boat, and the boat was sort of swaying. I had like 30 or 40 people on there. But yeah, I think people react pretty well, actually, and they're always interested to see like how it works. Especially, I think, because it's a sort of World War II naval boat that gets people interested. Yeah, initially I was quite defensive about it. And I sort of had this fear of being judged for sort of not living in a sort of normal way. And it's also been helpful to get over that self-consciousness.
You've been persuading me that boat life is where I should go next. I won't tell the community that yet. I'll give them another year. But what one piece of advice would you give to somebody who's considering boat life?
Get a boat with insulation. That's the key thing. Yeah, there are some really beautiful ones out there, but you've got to make sure it's insulated.
Kind of on the same theme of what piece of advice, what do you wish you had known before you moved onto a boat?
I wish I'd known to stock up on wood. And I wish I'd known more about the dynamics of heat transfer and how to stop things from getting damp. That was a learning experience. I would come home in the evening and sort of all my sheets would be damp and they'd start getting moldy, and I was sort of drying them out. But then I didn't realize you need to sort of ventilate, which is like just a very obvious thing that I hadn't learned. So once I learned to do that, then it was a much more pleasant place to live.
Because you said about you didn't realise like how much of a community there would be. Do you think you wish you'd known that before? Or was it a nice pleasant surprise?
I guess that's something you sort of have to learn from the inside. It's kind of an insular community in some ways. People can be quite, I think, defensive. And once you live on a boat, then people will turn up and help you out with anything. But there is kind of a suspicion of other people sometimes. I guess I wish I'd got to know people more quickly.
So what things have you learned about yourself in the last year?
I've learned that I can cope with things that I didn't think I would be able to cope with. I think, yeah, previously I had this sense of myself as someone who's quite incompetent. I always think of this quote by Diana Atwell about Jean Rhys that you know, said that she was the person who's the least capable of dealing with life that she'd ever met, and would get overwhelmed by a mouse running through the kitchen. And I always thought of myself like that. And, you know, I was very reliant on other people to help me, even with, you know, even doing things like admin and, you know, dealing with like the everyday business of life. And this has been a real sort of trial by fire, but it has made me realize that I can do these things, and I can be responsible for myself in all sorts of ways. And I've had to grow up and sort of confront reality. And I guess I'm really grateful for that experience of just being faced with situations that I had to deal with. I think especially having been a student for so long, you end up relying on institutions to do a lot of these things. And I just had a real lack of confidence. And then, you know, last September, I traveled to Naples. And it was the first time I'd been abroad for years. And I'd always been afraid of going abroad alone. I was anxious. I thought, you know, I wouldn't be able to do it. I wouldn't be able to, like, manage speaking a different language and manage being in a new place. And the last year has given me a lot of confidence in actually my ability to do those things.
And how has discernment been part of this process in the last year?
I think it was losing a lot of the things that I thought I wanted, like a stable home and a job with this clear career progression. I had to really think about what I wanted and where God was leading me and where my particular skills were. So I was sort of on the path to becoming an Anglican priest. I was discerning ordination. And I thought that that was where I was being called because I wanted to sort of give my life to God in a more serious way. Throughout that process of discernment, I realized that my skills were in theological education and pastoral care, and sort of working particularly with people who are vulnerable and people who are on the margins. And I've been able to do that over the last year as a Catholic. And that's been really fruitful, especially sort of learning to detach that sense of vocation from what is, I guess, socially sanctioned or what sort of formal opportunities there are. I realized the vocation is something a lot more personal and not something I can sort of plan. It's something that, you know, God will take me on and sort of keep revealing new paths and new possibilities. It's not a sort of destination.
That's such a good summing up of vocation. I really enjoyed that. I guess my final question for you is, what have you been grateful for over the last year?
I've been really grateful for friends and community and, yeah, just people who come through in amazing ways, in ways I really didn't expect. Like when I moved onto the boat, people came and helped me clear it out. And, you know, it was full of books, but they all needed to be sort of cleared out of spiders and cobwebs and mold and stuff. So we had several weeks of doing that on the deck. And yeah, it's made me really appreciative of community, but also of my own ability to meet my needs. And I guess, you know, you have to put your own oxygen mask on first, right? You have to be able to be someone who can take care of your needs before you can help others. And I think I've become someone who's able to participate in a community and be there for others by developing that confidence in myself and my own capacity.
I love that quote about putting your own oxygen mask on first, because it's one of the things that I realize I would say a lot to people, but I didn't do myself. And so it's one of the things I've also really learned this last year as well. So I feel like that's nice that we've both learned that this year. Thank you so much for your time, Rosa. It's been a really interesting conversation. Thanks for listening to Things I Wish I Knew. I know this episode is going to stay with me, particularly because of the way that Rose talks about vocation being really personal. And that was something that I really can understand. But please do recommend this episode to a friend. And how about you? We'd love to hear how Rose's story resonated with you. And why not also tell us if you're facing an experience you wish you knew how to look at differently? It might just be something we can help with. Write to me at jcorcoran@thinkingfaith.org and find out more about the themes we discussed today at thinkingfaith.org. Please do join me next time.